Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
The market continued its dive today. The president blames the Fed. It's Christmas Eve. Of course it'll be slow. Just kidding. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, December 24th. Good to have you with us. Used to be Christmas Eve was a pretty reliably slow news day. I could come in, fill in for Kai, take it easy. Nope, not today. In a short day of trading, the market continued its slide. The Dow finished down more than 600 points, nearly 3%. The federal government is partially shut down and doesn't seem to be in a huge rush to figure things out. And the president was on Twitter, blasting the Federal Reserve for the sliding market and the overall economy. Fed officials don't have a feel for the market, he tweeted. The Fed is like a powerful golfer who can't score because he has no touch. He can't putt. Over the weekend, there were reports Trump wanted to replace Fed Chair Jerome Powell, reports which Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin tried to walk back. But Mnuchin also made investors jittery. He called the heads of major banks to confirm everything was okay. Just because. To make some sense of this, we've called up Benjamin Applebaum from the New York Times. Thanks for being here.
Glad to join you.
So there were reports over the weekend that Trump has asked his advisors if he can remove Powell. And I want to start with just that big picture question here. Can he?
It's a really big and open question at the moment. The law says that he can only remove a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, quote, for cause, unquote. And most legal scholars basically think that that means you can't remove the head of the Fed just because you don't like his policymaking decisions. But there's a separate question about whether he could be removed as the chairman of the Board of Governors, even just because the president wants to. The law doesn't address that directly, and some legal scholars think the president has greater latitude to remove Powell from the chairman's job than to remove him entirely from the Board of Governors.
What would the implications be if he did push him out, if he tried to push him out even?
You know, I spoke with a stock market analyst yesterday who said what we've seen to this point in the markets would pale in comparison to what happened if the president removed Powell. And the reason is basically that financial markets have a really strong preference for allowing technocrats to manage monetary policy. They don't want interest rates in the hands of politicians. The whole reason for the creation of the Fed was to avoid a situation in which politicians, like the president, could exert pressure on the Fed to hold down rates in the short term, goosing the economy, but causing it to overheat. So the fear of the markets would be that the removal of Powell would signal a loss of independence for the Fed, and there'd be a likelihood that investors would respond to that in a way that none of us would probably appreciate.
Right. Are there other ways the president could move the Fed more to his way of thinking without sort of pushing Powell out?
Yeah, and you know what's so striking here is that past presidents have often exercised pressure on the Fed quite successfully in a variety of more subtle ways. So probably the most obvious and important is that the president gets to decide who sits on the Fed's board. He appointed Powell. He's appointed three of the other four governors so far. Two more nominees are waiting for Senate confirmation. What's striking is that all of those people appear to be committed to raising interest rates. So the president
is
pretty systematically. Yeah, he's chosen people who don't agree with him about monetary policy, which is kind of remarkable. Past presidents have been much more careful to pick people for the Fed's board who do agree with them. Presidents also have sought to pressure the Fed privately and publicly through history, essentially by jawboning in the same way that Trump is. But most of them have been much more subtle and discreet about it.
So the president being as public as he has been maybe contributed to the big market drop today. But we also saw Steven Mnuchin make investors, it seemed, nervous when he started calling bank heads, sort of saying, no, no, everything's fine. Don't panic, when no one was panicking. What do you make of that?
It was a remarkable display. You know, Secretary Mnuchin has been under enormous pressure from the president to calm the stock market. I think President Trump believes that the stock market can be made to go back up, and he's demanding that someone do that. And Secretary Mnuchin responded to that pressure by reaching out to the heads of banks to have these conversations on Sunday, where he basically sought their assurance that everything is going fine. But as you say, it was the equivalent of announcing that a problem didn't exist. No one thought it existed. It's like saying, you know, everybody rest easy. We have plenty of zombie vaccine in store. And all of a sudden people are thinking about zombies. So it was a very odd performance, and it really appears to have contributed to the market's decline today. It really freaked people out. It's the type of thing we only hear Treasury secretaries saying when things are actually going quite badly.
So you think it was just a misplayed hand?
It certainly feels like it, yeah. And we've heard that, frankly, from observers across the political spectrum, that it just feels like Mnuchin made a mistake, that he gave the market comfort in a form that the market found very disconcerting.
Benjamin Applebaum from the New York Times, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So just how bad was it today? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This summer, Toys R Us closed its stores for good after spending nearly a year in bankruptcy. And in doing, it changed Christmas toy buying as we know it. The closings reshuffled the prospects of toy makers. It left the Marine Corps' holiday charity Toys for Tots reeling. It also meant moms like me had one less place to hunt for the perfect Hot Wheels set. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra headed out to ask holiday shoppers how they're managing to get through the season with the giraffe-shaped void in our retail landscape.
Back before Toys R Us was brought down by e-commerce and a ton of debt from a buyout deal, it was magical. And not just for kids, for parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts. Like Liz Laura, she's 42, lives in Queens, and she's been hunting for Christmas gifts for her two nephews, ages 4 and 8. She used to just go to Toys R Us.
The kids would watch a commercial and say, hey, I want that, and you knew that you would be able to find it in Toys R Us.
But this year, without the giant toy retailer, it's coming down to the wire, Christmas Eve.
Yesterday, I went to the mall, and I couldn't find any toys that that I thought they would like, and so now I ended up here.
Here is Kidding Around, a small, independent toy store at Grand Central in Manhattan. It mostly sells specialty toys. You got your peacock stuffed animal, a Statue of Liberty made of building blocks, a toy New York City bus. And this year, Austin Frawley, who runs the store, has started stocking some bigger brands, too. Marvel action figures and Nerf guns. Because that's what customers have been asking for.
With Toys R Us being gone, we had to start bringing it in because the last thing you want to do as a brick-and-mortar store is say, no, 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 we don't have it. Go shop online.
Shoppers who've gone to other stores have come away disappointed. Alex Condon from New Jersey has a 12-year-old son, just went to Target to buy him Legos, and found the shelves almost empty.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, what is going on here?
Condon says that never would have happened at a Toys R Us. He would know. He worked there for more than 20 years. He says during the holidays,
we had storeroom full of extra stuff, and we filled it up nightly.
And with toys that really flew off the shelves, they'd restock by the hour. Every child's dream. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The destination for a lot of those toys? Under the tree. Coming up tomorrow on Marketplace Morning Report, a look at the science behind growing the perfect Christmas tree. There are few last-minute gifts as easy to buy and as hard to get right as perfume. These days, buying perfume is expensive. A bottle can easily cost more than $100. Niche perfumes can be way more than that. So perfume reviews offered up in the new book, Perfumes the Guide 2018, could help. Or at least amuse. One fragrance in the book is described as smelling like cheap 1950s hair gel. The authors say another smells like a mall in hell. The first version of the book came out in 2008. Tanya Sanchez is the co-author of both. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You published your first guide to perfumes 10 years ago, and I wonder how the industry's changed in the last decade.
Very much. We actually got rather burned out on perfume after we wrote the first guide, where we reviewed about 1,800 perfumes more. So we weren't paying very much attention for a few years. And when we looked back at the department stores, it was absolutely amazing what had changed. When we wrote the guide in 2007, a celebrity perfume was all the rage. And a lot of things were discontinued, changing. Things didn't smell the same. We were really depressed about it. And then when we went back to the shops, suddenly it was a whole new world of niche perfume, perfumes that are not by big brands, are by very small producers, are by sort of artisans. It was extremely exciting.
And so what accounts for the change? I mean, I guess the first question is, what happened to all the classic perfumes? Where did they go?
Well, they didn't really go. I mean, some of them have been discontinued, but there were changes in the market. So people were thought to like fresher perfumes, grapefruit perfumes, fruity perfumes, things that smelled more like body sprays. So sort of the old classics weren't doing as well as they used to. So they started to kind of phase them out or try to freshen them up for a younger audience. The other thing that happened was that in Europe, there was a lot of allergen regulation that was passed. People were getting itchy. So it was sort of a terrible confluence of events.
And then you look out and all of a sudden you see all these niche perfumes and niche perfumers. Where did they come from?
So I think the internet has made an enormous difference in perfume culture. The fact that I can even talk about perfume culture is itself an internet
phenomenon. What is perfume culture? Let me stop you. What is perfume culture?
I mean, there has arisen a world of people who are really desperately interested in perfume. It's no longer simply the case that a person wants to just buy one perfume, smell of that every day, or just when they go out, you know. Now there are people who are interested in perfume as a subject. So they want to try lots of different perfumes. They want to try strange perfumes. They want to try exotic perfumes, foreign perfumes, everything. So there's a lot of chatter, and where there's chatter, there's creativity.
And can you make a good perfume as a self-taught perfumer?
Yes, obviously not everyone does. I mean, there's a lot of crap out there. But for instance, we gave 5 stars, which is our highest rating, to Andy Tower, a self-taught perfumer in Switzerland who had a day job as a chemist. And he was just passionate about perfume, and he started to put together his own stuff. And his perfume, L'Air du Désert Marocain, I'm sorry, you have to speak a lot of French if you're going to talk about perfume, got 5 stars from us. And in fact, Luca Turin, my co-author and husband, wore it to our wedding.
Wow.
And Andy has never, so far as I know, been professionally trained.
What are you loving? What smells do you love right now?
Well, I mean, I don't want to brag, but right now I am wearing a recently issued perfume, which is a recreation of a really old perfume by the French brand Jacques Fat. And the people who bought the brand wanted to restore some of their old perfumes, including one which Luca and many people consider to be one of the greatest fragrances of all time, which was Iris Gris, which means gray iris. And unfortunately, it is priced over $1,000 a bottle.
Wow.
Which I find offensive. I mean, and it is basically a peach chypre, which is a sort of classic perfume category, with a huge, lovely, juicy, fuzzy peach. And over it, this wonderful, sober, gray, dignified iris, which is sort of like what violet would be like if it was depressed. And sometimes people say, you know, perfume is not an art. And often they say this in the industry because they'd like to not have to make excuses for the crap they do. But when I smell something like this, I am moved. And I don't think that one would be moved like this unless there were art involved.
Tanya Sanchez is co-author of Perfumes, The Guide. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, ever wondered how subscription boxes make money?
increasing consumption, but having real delight and joy and utility.
The CEO of Birchbox. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 653 points, 2.9%, to close at 21,792. The Nasdaq shed 140 points, 2.2%, to end at 6,192. And the S&P 500 was off 65 points, 2.7%, to finish at 2,351. As we mentioned earlier in the show, President Trump's ongoing attacks on the Federal Reserve, paired with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's weekend calls to bank CEOs, did everything but calm the markets. Bank shares fell. Wells Fargo drove down 3.3%. Oil prices slipped amid concerns about global oversupply and general economic climate. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
You make financial decisions every day, from minor transactions to major life choices. And that's why Marketplace covers the economy from so many different angles, connecting the dots between the micro and the macro. As a nonprofit organization, we depend on individuals like you to help us provide trustworthy news that adds value to your life. If you're not yet a Marketplace investor, please contribute today at marketplace.org, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. It's not just markets here in the U.S. struggling. British indexes are on their way to their worst performance since the 2008 financial crisis. Concerns over Brexit are at the top of the list of investor worries. And the effects of Brexit, however it plays out, will have significant spillover. Britain's departure from the EU could be a big deal for Ireland's multi-billion dollar horse racing industry. The BBC correspondent Chris Page reports.
The galloping patter of the horse auctioneers here at Goffs in County Kildare is drumming up thousands of euros.
What is Ireland best at? Well, apart from rugby these days, Ireland is best as a world leader in thoroughbred racing and breeding. It's hard to be the national industry. It's in the psyche.
Henry Beebe is chief executive of the firm, which is the second biggest bloodstock sales company in Europe. The racehorses Goffs has sold have included Arkle, Red Rum and Lascargo. Henry's concerned that Brexit could throw up bureaucratic and economic hurdles.
British and Irish racing is really one industry. Britain doesn't produce enough foals to be able to serve its own fixture list, so it needs imports. Ireland is the biggest breeder in Europe, so it is absolutely imperative that there is no restriction of freedom of movement, both of people or horses, that there aren't any tariffs. Heretofore, we've had a tripartite agreement between Ireland, Britain and France. The tripartite agreement allows for the free movement between those three countries, which has been signed off by veterinarians. Now, the authorities in the three countries have been working on what's called a high health status, which means that all countries will hit certain standards and they would be able to agree that they would have free movement. But that will need political agreement.
That unease is shared by those who breed the horses which are on show at Goffs. Shane O'Dwyer leads the Irish Thoroughbred Breeders Association.
Under that tripartite agreement, we can all computerise to Brussels. There's a process which allows the movement of horses, which is painless. So you take it that you have horses that are going over for covering, you have horses that are going over racing, highly strung animals, in a queue while there are border checks is going to be very, very difficult. So we hope that will never happen.
The horses, which the breeders breed and the auctioneers sell, eventually hit the track somewhere like this. I'm at Dundalk Stadium. It's a few miles from the border with Northern Ireland, so the bookies even accept stakes in two currencies. But trainers like John Ox don't think Brexit is a good bet.
Two aspects to it is the economic situation. If Brexit has an adverse effect on British economy, that's going to affect trade. If there was such a thing as a hard border, it's going to have other problems. There's likely to be no particularly good outcome for us, you know, other than Britain is still in the customs union and things like that. That would make a big difference.
And Pat Martin, he also trains racehorses, hopes crossing the land border won't become more complicated.
Like the old days travelling up the north, you wouldn't know how long it was going to take you to get across the border. And were you training in the days when there was a hard border?
Yeah. Like, it's an hour and a half for us to get to Belfast. It could have took you 3 hours. It's just extra planning, which you didn't need.
Yeah.
Hopefully that never comes back. And that's just the practicalities of it without money coming into it, you know?
At Goff's, the pace of the selling is relentless. And Henry Beebe sums up his thoughts with a plead for speed.
I think as an industry, we can go to the politicians with solutions, but they have to be willing to listen to them. Huge frustration is the lack of clarity, the rowing, the arguing. You want to knock their heads together, really, don't you? Get on with it. That's what we would say.
That was the BBC's Chris Page from Ireland. Last-minute shoppers staring at the picked-over holiday displays, there's always the subscription box. These days, there are boxes that'll deliver everything from dog chews to gluten-free snacks, monthly, to your doorstep. One of the veteran brands in the industry is Birchbox. It's been delivering sample-size beauty products since 2010, so you can try that dry shampoo before you buy it. Over that time, both the beauty industry and the subscription box industry have changed. Joining us now is Birchbox CEO and co-founder, Katia Beecham. Katia, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I want to start with a question about the business model of beauty subscription boxes, something I've wondered for a long time, which is, are you in the business of selling full-sized products or are you in the business of selling boxes of samples?
It's a great question. I think it really actually differs by company. At Birchbox, we really think about changing the path to purchase, changing the potential customer for beauty. And that comes in the format of starting with a subscription. But that is what we call the appetizer to the entree of changing what you're buying in full size. So for us, we think of it as how do we get you from basically less consumption of things that are not exciting for you or just kind of become rote or routine to increasing consumption, but having real delight and joy and utility from the products you're buying.
Birchbox recently announced a partnership with Walgreens, and I wonder how that fits into the model and the vision that you've laid out.
Yes, it fits in very nicely. I mean, obviously, the Walgreens company as a whole is massive and serving every consumer in America. But when we looked closely at who is currently consuming beauty there and who they think there's an opportunity to consume beauty there, there was a clear overlap with the psychographic that we call the casual beauty consumer, not a consumer, again, who is so passionate that they're prioritizing, but where it's a little bit more about convenience. A lot of times the casual beauty consumer is consuming at drugstores and at grocery because there's a perception that, you know, that's lower price. And that's true, you know, to an extent, but the lines are definitely blurring between mass beauty pricing and what's called prestige beauty pricing. So we love the idea that we can have the potential of being in front of, you know, the 70% population, which is really massive.
Can you move, though, the traditional sort of $7 CoverGirl mascara shopper to a $25 more prestige brand mascara, or is that not what you're going for here?
It's some of what we're going for, but not through what I'd call like a traditional lens of like pressure selling. It's you can sample all of these products for $10 a month and choose for yourself. So we've been pretty profoundly impressed that, you know, none of us, for example, when we started the company, would have ever said we'd buy, you know, a $30 shampoo. And then you find like all of our customers, when they sample it, you know, a really large proportion of them decide to buy a $30 shampoo. And we've just really found, yeah, you can absolutely move the needle. Like I said, doubling the spend of the average customer that starts at Birchbox within a year is the trend we've seen.
Where do you fall in the beauty spectrum? Are you a passionate consumer or a more casual?
Very much cash, but very informed now. So it's a little bit skewed. I'd say the whole reason we started Birchbox was that, you know, my co-founder and I were in business school. We thought we were pretty smart. And we were like, this is so confusing. And I don't care enough to research
figure it out,
you know?
Right.
But like, I do want to have nice skin my whole life and not have to do, you know, I want to know how to do these things, but I certainly just do not want to put in the time because it's not my, like, it's not that important to me. And so we started realizing, you know what, everybody else is competing for the same customer, this like passionate consumer, the one that you see on Instagram and on YouTube. There's a huge opportunity and we're naturally attracting a different audience that sees this intersection of like delight and efficacy as a better way to consume. You know, that still says like, you know, we put a box of adorable samples in front of you. There's a delight component for sure. But, you know, the purpose is that you find things you love, you're throwing things away, you're an empowered and informed consumer. And when you do buy something that's expensive, more expensive than, you know, a mass product, you use it all up because you really liked it.
Katia Beecham is co-founder and CEO of Birchbox. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This final note before we go today. Now through the end of the year is expected to be one of the busiest times at movie theaters. And 2018 has already been a good one for the box office. Theaters will sell nearly $12 billion in tickets this year, a 6% increase over last. And it's not just because they're charging more. Attendance is up, which makes some sense to me. There are times when getting away from the rush of the news or the crush of family sounds awfully appealing. Today, the Dow fell 653 points, 2.9%. The Nasdaq shed 140 points, 2.2%. And the S&P 500 was off 65 points, 2.7%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhurst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, Phoebe Unterman, and Daniel Shen. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.